frankly, integrated deterrence is well-executed, actual, just hardcore deterrence. Deterrence, it's a political strategic construct. It is a psychological construct. Special operations, psychological operations, political warfare, the U.S. Information Agency, all these different tools of national power being used together to articulate that, no, for reals, we're serious here. Like, if you do this, there will be consequences that you do not want to endure.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. This is Chris Park from Johns Hopkins SAIS. The Biden administration released its National Defense Strategy in late October that laid out how the Department of Defense will implement the president's national security strategy. The concept of integrated deterrence is at the core of the 2022 National Defense Strategy. What is integrated deterrence? Can it work to address increasingly complex security challenges faced by the United States? Dr. Kathleen McGinnis joins us today to discuss integrated deterrence. Kathleen McGinnis is a senior fellow and director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before joining CSIS, she served as a specialist in international security at the Congressional Research Service, as a research consultant at Chatham House, and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense working on NATO operations in Afghanistan. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you.
Well, the integrated deterrence, the concept, is the topic of today's conversation. And of course, the central theme of the National Defense Strategy that was released last month. Over the next half hour, I wanted to get a better sense of what the concept means. But to first situate our discussion today, what is the National Defense Strategy?
The National Defense Strategy is a congressionally mandated defense review or Pentagon review of the its overall plans and strategic direction. The requirement first got started in the 90s. It was known as the Quadrennial Defense Review. It was initially sort of done on a voluntary basis by the Pentagon, and then it got turned into a statutory requirement in the mid to late 90s. And so the initial process was about going from bottom to top, top to bottom, and aligning the Pentagon's overall strategic direction with the resourcing and programs required to implement those visions. And again, relooking at that every 4 years. The National Defense Strategy is the successor document. And so in about 2016, I believe, I think that's right, 2016, Congress sort of looked at the QDR process and said, you know, this thing is its own unwieldy beast unto its own. It is costing tons and tons of time and manpower. This is a tail wagging the dog kind of situation. So they reformed the defense, the Quadrennial Defense Review, and turned it into the National Defense Strategy, which was a much more tight, top-down driven document instead of, you know, bottom up. And the first one was produced under the Trump administration, and it was actually, you know, most observers would say that it was a pretty good document. It was the one that sort of took that framed out the Pentagon's major strategic challenge as strategic competition with China. And there was also, it was done in conjunction with the national security strategy at the time. So the two documents pivoted off of each other quite nicely, but we had the statement of, you know, this is the overall strategic direction for the Pentagon. Also in the statutory requirement is, you know, the Pentagon is required to articulate risks and trade-offs in the National Defense Strategy. So, make clear priorities, articulate risks. So some of that stuff is in the classified version of the document. But it's again, the big picture strategic document for the Pentagon and how it, how it views the world, and how it plans to align programs and priorities in order to accomplish its strategic direction.
Well, another document that articulates risks, articulates trade-offs, and present this big picture strategy of the administration is the National Security Strategy, which was also released in late October by the Biden administration. And it delineated kind of the national security concerns and how the administration plans to deal with them. How does the National Defense Strategy, which you just discussed, work in tandem with the National Security Strategy?
So I think it's perhaps more useful to think about it as a hierarchy. The National Security Strategy is done by the White House, and it is the overall executive branch's articulation of, again, how it sees the strategic environment and how it plans to address risks and opportunities within that strategic environment at a very broad level. It's very much an articulation of overall intent. The National Defense Strategy is how the Pentagon itself is going to be implementing its part of the National Security Strategy. Now, it's worth digressing for a hot second, because, you know, every 4 years, by the way, the National Security Strategy is also a statutory requirement that was established in 1986. The Goldwater-Nichols Defense Reform Act created this requirement for a national security strategy at that time, the timing was different. But anyway, there was a requirement for this national security strategy. So the executive branch is on the hook to produce it. And every time it's produced, every time it's released, the strategic studies community, there's a weeping and gnashing of teeth, because the documents rarely, if ever, align ends, ways, and means, right? When we think about strategy, what we like to see is an articulation of where we want to go, an articulation of how we want to get there, and the resources required to do so, right? Ends, ways, means. These documents never have that, ever. They're usually, this laundry list of things that the administration is doing or plans to do, and, you know, sort of going from there. National Security Strategy is a bit of a misnomer. What it is useful, though, for is again, like getting a window into how the administration views the world. And you can sort of begin to make predictions about how the team is going to respond to a given crisis based on what's in those documents and the overall strategic approach. But trying to like actually articulate or try to find a strategy rather within these documents is an exercise in futility and frustration.
Well, I think this cues up our discussion today really well about how the National Defense Strategy and the concept of integrated deterrence can perhaps be a window into what the administration is thinking, and perhaps give us, you know, an ounce of clue about its ends, ways, or means, as you mentioned. And I wanted to read a direct quote from the 2022 National Defense Strategy that stated that integrated deterrence entails working seamlessly across warfighting domains, theaters, and spectrums of conflict, all instruments of U.S. national power, and our network of alliances and partnerships. And I first wanted to touch on how integrated deterrence alludes to the need for seamless interagency response to global threats. What does integrated deterrence mean for how different U.S. government bodies, the Pentagon, the State Department, the Treasury, and what have you, operate and work with each other?
So once again, there has been considerable weeping and gnashing of teeth at the term integrated deterrence and how prominent a role it has played in both the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy. And the reason being is because nobody, as a lot of scholars will say, we don't know what it means. We just don't know what this means. Is this just yet another Pentagon buzzword? You know, a couple of years ago, the buzzword was partnerships. A couple of years ago, it was irregular warfare. Is this just yet another tagline that we're going to be adding to budget justifications? And, you know, nothing really changes. I tend to take a different view of this, which is that when we think about what deterrence is and integrated deterrence, actually, frankly, integrated deterrence is well executed, actual, just hardcore deterrence. Why do I say that? Deterrence, it's a political strategic construct. It is a psychological construct. Deterrence is about convincing an adversary not to do something you don't want them to do. And there's all sorts of different ways that that can be communicated. And the specific context with deterrence is convincing an adversary you don't want them to do something by threatening to inflict pain of some kind that is unwithstandable or it's just too great to embark on a particular course of action, right? So to put a little more concrete detail or more historical example, we were deterring the Soviet Union from invading Western Europe by threatening overwhelming force and overwhelming punishment of an aggression against NATO countries, right? And vice versa. The Warsaw Pact was doing the same. And there was this elaborate construction of conventional forces, nuclear forces, and so on. But special operations, psychological operations, political warfare, all, you know, the U.S. Information Agency, all these different tools of national power being used together to articulate that no, for reals, we're serious here. Like if you do this, there will be consequences that you do not want to endure. And you, in this case, being the Soviet Union. So going back to today, when people think about or look at this construct of integrated deterrence, you're like, well, hang on a second. If deterrence is to be effective, it has to be integrated with other instruments of national power, right? You have to be signaling with everything you have that you intend to inflict, you know, disastrous consequences on a adversary if they embark on a particular course of action. And it's not enough to have just the military doing that. It's got to be the State Department. It's got to be USAID to some extent. It's all got to work together to convince an adversary that we're serious. And, you know, Moscow during the Cold War was looking for cracks in, you know, and likewise, the DC was looking at Moscow for cracks. Do they really mean it? What does this particular military exercise mean here? Does it mean that they're actually diverting priority from this theater to that? Those sorts of things. So there's a lot of guesswork that's been happening on either side, and sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong. But the point is that the overall strategy is supposed to be integrated with everybody else within the interagency, and also with allies and partners. You need to have consistent NATO signaling, right? You need to have a consistent message from NATO allies that a particular course of action is unacceptable to the alliance, right? Because Moscow at the time was looking for cracks in the alliance too. So yeah, so a lot of scholars have been like, okay, this is not a great construct here in integrated deterrence, because all we're doing is saying the exact same thing we should be doing in the first place. I would submit that actually that's the Pentagon itself has kind of gotten away from that understanding, and that integrated deterrence is about trying to address that.
Right. So you mentioned how, you know, the left hand of the U.S. government should know what the right hand is doing and vice versa. And this is just an articulation of what should have been happening. And I understand that, you know, there has been efforts to, you know, institute this interagency dialogue, interagency communication, especially following 9/11. But I'm wondering how significant a change will the national defense strategy and articulation of integrated deterrence at this top-down strategic document bring to the existing structures of interagency processes? Or is it, as you said, is it just another Pentagon buzzword, a word that will not necessarily institute any meaningful changes to how these government agencies operate?
So I think my My answer to that would be somewhere in the middle of those two options, right? So I think the utility of integrated deterrence within a Pentagon construct is that it actually helps remind us what, you know, the basics of what deterrence actually is. You know, in recent years, I would say, like over the past 15 in particular, the word deterrence has been used fast and loose in all sorts of lazy ways. It connotes the actual nuclear deterrent. It is, you know, also used as a term to describe, you know, we're gonna have some deterrence here, and that's gonna fix things. So we're gonna add some deterrence to Europe, and that'll fix the situation with Russian aggression. You know, like it, as if it's something that can be sprinkled onto, like in terms of conventional posture and solve problems. So the term has been used in a loosey-goosey manner, and what the document seems to be doing is saying, no, we need to go back to basics. We need to remember the first principles here, which are that in order for deterrence to be effective, it has to be integrated with other allies and partners. It has to be synchronized with the interagency. Now, so, okay, cool. So from that perspective, this is actually pretty helpful to remind us what the basics of this incredibly important construct that we're banking a lot on. The problem with the way that the current administration has articulated this, it's actually put DOD in the lead on integrated deterrence. And that actually doesn't make a lot of sense, because if the whole thing is about, you know, communicating a whole of government approach to convincing psychologically an adversary to do something that we don't want them to do based on a threat of overwhelming punishment, then this is not something that resides in the Pentagon itself. A key part of it does, you know, in terms of posture, in terms of military forces and forward stationing, nuclear capabilities, so on and so forth. But a whole lot of this is also the intelligence community, State Department, you know, diplomacy, using programs like foreign military sales and foreign military financing to shore up partnerships. You know, it's much broader than DOD itself, and so it's unfortunate. There seems to be a trick missed here in how the Biden administration is approaching integrated deterrence itself.
I also wanted to ask about the role of nuclear weapons in the national defense strategy and, of course, integrated deterrence. You know, you see China undergoing rapid nuclear modernization while Russia is threatening nuclear use in its ongoing invasion of Ukraine. So what role does the U.S. nuclear arsenal have in achieving integrated deterrence?
I think the answer to that is based on, you know, again, what does an adversary deem as, you know, its weaknesses and unacceptable damage, right? Again, deterrence is not a capability. It's not a weapon. It's a psychological calculation. Different actors, Russia certainly seems to emphasize its nuclear capabilities in its strategic communication. I mean, it's been nuclear saber rattling and seems to be paying significant attention to the nuclear capabilities of the United States and other NATO allies when choosing not to expand the conflict in Ukraine to NATO territories. So I think we can look at what's happening in Ukraine right now and Russia and say, you know, actually, nuclear weapons are playing a very important part of this. My understanding is that scholarship on the China question is a little bit mixed. That there is, you know, work that the Chinese are doing on its arsenal, but they're not quite interested yet in any sorts of arms control talks or things of that nature. So in terms of what would deter China from invasion of Taiwan, for example, it seems to me that nuclear weapons might be a part of that calculation. But equally, showing political support for Taiwan, it may be, you know, and exercising, training, doing other mechanisms, other instruments of national power to convince Beijing that the costs of invading Taiwan are just not worth it. There's other instruments that might also play an equal, if not more important, role. That said, man, it's important to pay attention to nukes. It's important to pay attention to the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and how the U.S. is thinking about and investing in the nuclear weapons complex's modernization. There are actors out there that, again, prioritize and value nuclear weapons as part of their defense and strategic postures. And as long as that's the case, the United States is going to need to have its own nuclear weapons as well. After the end of the Cold War, the nuclear weapons infrastructure was not significantly invested in, and not to the level that many observers would say would have been sufficient. And so there's a lot of work to do to make sure that we have a nuclear deterrent that is capable of responding to the kinds of different needs that we have for it. And also to have the people, the systems, the facilities in place, again, and the training, doctrine, education on the military side to actually, you know, execute the nuclear mission. There's work to be done. You can't take your hands off the wheel on that stuff.
I wanted to now move on to, I guess, another leg of integrated deterrence, in that the National Defense Strategy also calls for establishing integrated deterrence by working with allies and partners, as you mentioned earlier. What does returning to, you know, these first principles of deterrence look like in practice for how the United States works with its allies and partners? Is it a question of simply stationing more missiles and other weapon systems in allied countries, let's say in Japan or South Korea? Does it also involve a degree of political harmony within the American network of allies and partners?
I would say very much the latter, and the former is informed by the latter. In other words, the, you know, close strategic dialogues and consultations with allies and partners, often with interagency processes, it's so much work to get other partners in the interagency on board for particular policy. It takes so much work that we sort of brief allies at the end of this ridiculously difficult sausage making process. We're like, oh, this is what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And the allies are like, oh, okay, here we go. The Biden administration seems to have taken that note and are saying that, you know, actually we need to be much better at the political synchronization and political military synchronization and consultation and collaboration with allies and partners through all phases of planning processes. So that's a step in the right direction, because without that kind of consultation, without those close communications, it's really hard to understand, you know, what are the deterrence needs of allies and partners? What do they think will make them more or less safe? And it's also easy to for an adversary to look at a particular ally partner and be like, well, actually, the U.S. isn't really prioritizing them, so we can start making mischief in you know, X, Y, or Z country. So from that perspective, you know, the consultation, the coordination, that emphasis on bringing together allies and partners at the front end is a really quite a welcome development. I should note that other administrations and other national security strategies and national defense strategies have also, you know, pretty consistently noted the importance of allies and partners and how though they are an amazing competitive advantage for the United States strategically. But this team seems to be taking on board the actual brass tacks of the need to coordinate early and often. Whether or not they're actually able to do so, given the press of events and everything going on, that's something that remains to be seen.
Like you said, you know, everyone is trying to figure this out. We have people in and outside the U.S. government thinking about this. We obviously have Russia, China, our adversaries looking at this. And obviously, you know, we have allies and partners also, you know, reading these documents and trying to understand what integrated deterrence means and anticipating what you just said, this early coordination efforts made by the Biden administration could look like. So I'm wondering, how are allies and partners responding to integrated deterrence? And is it a panacea, I guess, to kind of the alliance coordination issues that the United States has, you know, been having for, I guess, like forever?
You know, I wouldn't feel comfortable commenting on allies and partners and their perspective on this, because, you know, I think that each country has their own views. But it's certainly not a panacea. Because actually implementing integrated deterrence, actually doing it properly, I mean, it's just so much work that, you know, we have a document that says we're going to do this stuff. Now you actually have to do it. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And so whether or not it actually plays out in practice is something that remains to be seen. I would also note that, you know, while as you very well articulate that, you know, that allies, adversaries, everybody's looking at these documents trying to figure out what they mean, I take the view that this national defense strategy is almost best viewed as a management document. It's about taking priorities, many of which were articulated in the 2018 national defense strategy under the Trump administration, taking those forward and discerning ways to actually get the Pentagon, get, you know, to the extent it possible, the interagency more focused in its business processes and other management processes to actually achieve this whole of government way of deterring adversaries and managing the strategic competition with China. I mean, like, anybody who's worked in the bureaucracy knows how hard it is to get anything done, how hard it is to turn the ship in any particular direction. And I think that this document does a pretty good job saying how this administration intends to keep turning the ship. And again, the priority is, the pacing challenge is China here. So thinking about all of these different tools and suites and how to align them to deter China, but also to, you know, contain Russia, I think it's a really important thing to state for the department, how it's planning to get these things done.
Well, that's precisely the point that I wanted to conclude our discussion today. And as you said, the Biden administration has identified China as, I guess, the largest geopolitical challenge, Russia as remaining a challenge in the national security strategy. And also, the United States also has a host of other challenges, you know, terrorism, instability around the world, and everything that the, as you say, the laundry list listed in the national security strategy. So is integrated deterrence a useful concept to deal with, you know, at least two and definitely more challenges in this increasingly unpredictable security environment? And I guess more specifically, how can integrated deterrence be tailored to this geopolitical situation where there are two or more adversaries or two or more simultaneous adversaries?
You know, you've asked the million-dollar question, in my view, which is, you know, and I don't know the answer to that. If deterrence and integrated deterrence is about communicating intent to an adversary and influencing decision making in a given capital, and you have to underscore credibility through the actions you are taking, that the signals you are sending are credible, it's hard enough to do that. It was hard enough to do that during the Cold War vis-a-vis the USSR. How to take this construct of integrated deterrence and apply it to multiple adversaries, I don't know. I'm really glad that there's really smart people working on this right now. Because, you know, any movement of forces or priority from one theater to another can easily be interpreted by an adversary as a lack of commitment, a lack of, and possibly an opportunity to push the envelope on where the deterrence red lines actually are. So if we take forces out of Europe and put them towards Indo-PACOM, might that create the conditions for Moscow to doubt U.S. political intentions vis-a-vis NATO? It's an abstract question, but when it comes down to these brass tacks of planning, it can have very, very serious implications for force movements, posture, and so on and so forth. So I just don't know. I just don't know the answer to that, how to tailor integrated deterrence. But I think that, as I said before, I'm glad that there's really smart people working on this. I hope that the community writ large has a robust debate on how to actually make this happen, because this is quite a strategic conundrum. I understand why the Biden administration has gone in that direction and why they view this as necessary. But making integrated deterrence credible to multiple adversaries is going to be quite challenging.
Well, I'm sure this is only the beginning of a lengthy and robust conversation about what integrated deterrence is and how it can work. But I want to thank you so much for joining us on this conversation today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.